A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and I immediately felt seen. He's tried to read Jane Jacobs, found her texts extraordinarily dense, and honestly, same. The question is, for lay people getting into urbanism, what's her actual vision for how cities should work, and how has it shaped the people who came after her? Let's translate the 400-page slog into something usable.
The timing on this is almost too good. Right now, cities everywhere are having an identity crisis. Downtowns are half empty because of remote work. There's serious momentum behind tearing out highways and pedestrianizing streets, and every planning department I've talked to is rethinking the car-first assumptions that dominated the 20th century. Jacobs was writing about exactly these dynamics in 1961, and her book has literally never gone out of print. 250,000 copies sold and counting.
Which is remarkable for a book that, as the prompt puts it, is extraordinarily dense and hard to understand for non-professionals. It's not beach reading.
It really isn't. And part of that is deliberate. She's building her case like a lawyer, chapter by chapter, with this relentless accumulation of street-level evidence. But the other part is that she was an outsider, a journalist, not an architect or planner, so she didn't write in the tidy categories the profession expected.
Who was she? And why did the entire planning establishment want her to go away?
Jane Jacobs moved to New York in the 1930s, worked as a secretary, then a journalist, wrote for Architectural Forum, which is funny because they later turned on her, and had zero formal training in architecture or urban planning. And in the 1950s and 60s, she took on Robert Moses, who was basically the most powerful unelected official in New York history. Moses wanted to ram the Lower Manhattan Expressway straight through Soho, Little Italy, and what's now called Greenwich Village. Would have displaced thousands of families and businesses.
Jacob said no.
She didn't just say no. She got herself arrested at a public hearing in 1968. She mobilized neighborhood opposition so effectively that the project died. And while she was doing all that, she wrote The Death and Life of Great American Cities, which came out in 1961, and systematically demolished the entire intellectual framework of mid-century planning.
Which was what, exactly? What was the framework she was demolishing?
The idea that a city is a machine, that you can model traffic flows, calculate optimal densities, separate uses into zones, housing here, offices there, shopping somewhere else, and design the whole thing from above like you're arranging furniture. This was the Radiant City model, named after Le Corbusier's vision, towers in a park, geometric order, everything rational and clean. And it gave us some of the worst urban environments ever built. The poster child. 33 high-rise buildings in St. Louis, designed by Minoru Yamasaki, the same architect who later did the World Trade Center. It was built in the mid-50s, won awards from architectural magazines, and was considered the future of public housing. It had open green space between towers, it had what planners called defensible space features, it looked great in models. And it was unlivable. Crime was rampant, the elevators were terrifying, the spaces between buildings were empty and dangerous. They demolished the whole thing on March 16, 1972. It lasted 16 years.
That's the lifespan of a poorly maintained car.
It wasn't an outlier. Jacob's whole argument was that this failure was predictable. Not because of the residents, not because of poverty, but because the design itself violated every principle of how human beings actually use urban space.
Let's get into those principles. You mentioned she has four conditions for a thriving city. Walk me through them.
Condition 1. Mixed primary uses. This means a district needs to serve more than one function, and ideally more than two. You want housing, workplaces, shops, entertainment, and civic buildings all within the same area. The reason is foot traffic timing. If a neighborhood is purely offices, it's dead after 6 p.m. and on weekends. If it's purely residential, it's dead during the workday. You need people coming and going at different times for different reasons, so the streets always have life.
Which is why the financial district in basically every city becomes a ghost town after hours.
and it's why Jacobs was so opposed to the single-use zoning that dominated American planning after the 1920s. Euclidean zoning, named after the Euclid versus Ambler Supreme Court case, not the Greek mathematician, separated everything into residential, commercial, and industrial zones. It made cities legible to planners and disastrous for street life.
All right. Condition 2.
This one sounds trivial, but it's not. Long blocks force pedestrians onto a few main routes. Short blocks create frequent intersections, which means more possible paths, more storefronts on corners, and more opportunities for what Jacobs called the sidewalk ballet. The unplanned, unchoreographed dance of people crossing paths, stopping at shops, chatting with neighbors. She argued that long blocks kill the economic and social ecosystem of a street because they concentrate foot traffic onto too few channels.
It's basically fractal. More intersections mean more edges, and edges are where interesting things happen.
That's exactly the right way to think about it, and this is measurable. Jan Geel, who we'll get to later, did time-lapse studies in Copenhagen, showing that people walk slower and stop more often on streets with short blocks and varied facades. On long, uniform blocks, they speed up and don't stop. Buildings of varying ages. This one's subtle. Jacobs argued that a healthy neighborhood needs a mix of old and new buildings because old buildings are cheaper. They've depreciated. They can house the oddball businesses, the used bookstore, the experimental theater, the startup that can't afford new construction. If every building is new, only high-margin tenants can afford the rent, and you get a monoculture of chain stores and luxury apartments. Urban diversity requires economic diversity, and economic diversity requires a range of rent levels.
Which is also an argument against the kind of wholesale redevelopment that wipes a block clean and replaces it all at once. You lose that texture.
Incremental change, not tabula rasa. That was her whole thing. And condition 4, dense concentration of people. Not just density on paper, density that actually puts people on the sidewalk. She was very specific about this. Density has to be high enough to support the mixed uses, the transit, the street life. But it can't be achieved through towers and a park because those isolate people from the street. The density has to be woven into the fabric.
Those four conditions, mixed uses, short blocks, varied building ages, dense concentration, those are her formula for what she called urban vitality.
And the thing to understand is that they're interdependent. You can't just check one box. If you have mixed uses but long blocks, the foot traffic doesn't circulate properly. If you have short blocks and density, but every building is new and expensive, you get a wealthy monoculture. They all have to work together.
All right, so let's talk about what's probably her most famous idea, eyes on the street. I feel like this gets thrown around a lot without people knowing what it actually means.
It's one of the most misused concepts in urbanism. People think it just means more people walking around, or worse, more surveillance cameras. That's not it at all. Jacobs meant a very specific social mechanism. You need buildings oriented toward the sidewalk, windows, stoops, storefronts, so that residents and shopkeepers have a natural reason to watch the street. Not as a chore, not as a security guard, but because the street is interesting and their lives are connected to it.
The shopkeeper who comes out to sweep the sidewalk in the morning. The old woman watching from her second floor window. The guy at the corner deli who knows everyone's name.
The key word is informal. It's social monitoring by people who belong to the place. And it only works if there's actually something to watch, which loops back to mixed uses and short blocks. A street with nothing but blank walls and parking garage entrances has no eyes on it, no matter how many people live in the tower above.
This is where she broke hardest with the planning orthodoxy, right? They thought safety came from order and separation. She thought it came from complexity and overlap.
The orthodoxy was essentially separate everything, maximize open space, and let the police handle safety. Jacob said mix everything together, build to the street, and let the neighborhood handle safety. It was a complete inversion, and the establishment hated her for it. The American Institute of Architects basically called her a housewife, meddling in things she didn't understand.
Which is rich, given that the housewife understood how streets actually were better than the people designing Pruitt-Igoe.
There's an irony there that still hasn't fully landed in the profession, honestly.
Let's make this concrete. You mentioned Greenwich Village versus Stuyvesant Town. What's the contrast?
Greenwich Village is basically Jacob's laboratory. It's where she lived. Short blocks, mixed uses, buildings from multiple eras, some from the early 1800s, some from the 1920s, some newer. Streets like Bleecker and McDougal have ground floor shops with apartments above. There's Washington Square Park drawing people in. At almost any hour, there are people walking dogs, buying groceries, sitting on stoops, heading to jazz clubs. It's the sidewalk ballet in action. Stuytown is a massive housing development on the east side of Manhattan, built in the 1940s by Metropolitan Life. It's a superblock. The street grid is erased, replaced by a gated complex of red brick towers set in lawns. No through streets, no shops at ground level, no mixed uses. It's exclusively residential. The lawns are manicured and empty. The towers are identical. There's no reason for anyone who doesn't live there to walk through it, and no reason for residents to linger at ground level. It's the anti-Jacobs.
Yet it's considered a successful development in some ways. People live there.
It's not Pruitt-Igoe. It's middle-income, well-maintained, safe. But it's a dead zone in the urban fabric. It doesn't contribute to the life of the surrounding city the way Greenwich Village does. It's a fortress. Jacobs would say it succeeds despite its design, not because of it.
Those four conditions and the eyes on the street concept were radical in 1961. How did they actually travel? Who picked them up and ran with them?
The most direct heir is Jan Gehl, a Danish architect and urban designer. In 1971, 10 years after Jacobs, he published Life Between Buildings. And in the preface, he explicitly credits Jacobs with changing how he thought about cities. Gehl spent decades studying public spaces in Copenhagen, and he operationalized her ideas into actual design guidelines.
What does that mean, operationalized?
Jacobs wrote, "Short blocks make better streets." Gehl went out and measured it. He used time-lapse photography, pedestrian counts, behavioral mapping. He found that people walk faster past blank facades and slower past active storefronts. He documented exactly how far people are willing to walk before they need a bench. He quantified the optimal distance between street-level entrances to keep a block lively, roughly 15 to 20 doors per 100 meters. He turned Jacobs's intuition into data.
Copenhagen actually implemented this.
Stroget is the famous example. It's the world's longest pedestrian street, over a kilometer long, and in 1962, it was a traffic-choked car sewer. Copenhagen converted it to a pedestrian street based on Gehl's Jacobs, inspired observations about how people use public space. It was controversial at the time. Merchants thought it would kill business. Instead, it became the spine of Copenhagen's pedestrian network, and today it's one of the most vibrant shopping streets in Europe. The city kept adding pedestrian zones, and now Copenhagen is routinely ranked among the world's most livable cities.
Jacobs's ideas went from an activist manifesto to a data-backed design methodology in about a decade.
Then in the 1980s and 90s, they went mainstream in American planning through New Urbanism. The Congress for the New Urbanism was founded in 1993 by Andres Duany, Elizabeth Plater, Zyberk, and others. Their charter explicitly references Jacobs in its preamble. New urbanism is basically Jacobs codified into a planning movement, walkable neighborhoods, mixed uses, traditional street grids, buildings that face the street, public spaces that actually function as public spaces. Seaside was designed by Duany and Plater Zyberk in the early 80s, and it was the first new town built entirely on new urbanist principles. It's got front porches close to the sidewalk, narrow streets, mixed uses in the town center, a grid of short blocks. It was also the set for The Truman Show, which is either a compliment or a critique depending on who you ask.
There's a criticism of new urbanism that it tends to produce these picture-perfect towns that feel a little too curated, like urbanism as lifestyle product rather than organic growth.
That's a real tension. Jacobs was deeply skeptical of master planning even when it claimed to follow her principles. She believed cities should grow incrementally, from the bottom up, through thousands of small decisions by property owners and businesses. New urbanism, for all its Jacobs DNA, is still a top-down approach. A developer buys a big parcel and builds a whole town at once. There's a philosophical gap there that hasn't been fully resolved.
Where does that tension show up in practice today?
Barcelona's superblocks are the perfect case study. The city has been taking groups of 9 city blocks and restricting car traffic to the perimeter, turning the interior streets into pedestrian-first public spaces with benches, trees, playgrounds. The data is striking. Noise down, air pollution down, pedestrian activity up, local business revenue up. but critics, including some Jacobs-influenced urbanists, argue it's too planned, too top-down. They say Jacobs would have preferred organic, block-by-block change driven by residents, not a municipal program imposed from City Hall.
Yet the results are good.
The results are excellent. And that's the bind. What do you do when top-down planning produces Jacobs-compatible outcomes faster and more equitably than waiting for organic change? In neighborhoods that have been starved of investment for decades, is it really realistic to wait for incremental bottom-up revitalization?
This is where Jeff Speck comes in, right?
Speck's book came out in 2012, and he's a fascinating figure in this lineage. He's a city planner who deeply admires Jacobs, but he argues that some problems require top-down design changes based on data. His big thing is that walkability isn't just about pleasant streets, it's about safety. He uses crash statistics to argue for narrower lanes, protected bike infrastructure, and intersection redesign. You can't incremental your way to a safer intersection. You need to rebuild it.
He's synthesizing Jacobs's human-scale sensibility with a more technocratic, data-driven approach.
And I think that's probably where the field is heading. The pure Jacobs position, bottom-up organic change, no master plans, is inspiring but incomplete. The pure top-down position gave us Pruitt-Igoe. The synthesis is, use data and planning authority to create the conditions for Jacobs-style street life, then get out of the way and let the neighborhood do its thing.
There's another layer here that I think is worth pulling on. The prompt mentioned that Jacobs' texts are dense and hard to read for non-professionals. Why is that exactly? What makes us so difficult?
Part of it is structural. The Death and Life of Great American Cities is not a breezy trade book. It's 450 pages of closely argued, evidence-heavy prose. She builds her case incrementally, chapter by chapter, like a prosecutor laying out exhibits. She'll spend 20 pages on the economics of a single city block. She doesn't do summaries or bullet points. You have to stay with her.
The prose itself.
It's actually very good prose. Vivid, opinionated, sometimes funny. But it's dense. Every sentence is doing work. There's no filler. If your attention drifts for a paragraph, you've missed a load-bearing beam in the argument. She also assumes you're willing to think about sidewalks and corner stores as serious subjects of study, which a lot of readers aren't prepared for.
What would you tell someone who wants to read her but is intimidated?
Read the first chapter. It's called The Uses of Sidewalk Safety, and it's the most accessible entry point. It lays out the eyes on the street argument in concrete, vivid terms, and it gives you a feel for her voice. If that chapter grabs you, keep going. If it doesn't, you've still gotten the core idea. Then walk your own block with her criteria in mind and see what you notice.
That's actually a good segue into the practical side of this. If someone's listening and wants to evaluate their own neighborhood through a Jacobs lens, what should they look for?
Start with the four conditions we talked about. 1. Is your street single-use or mixed? Do people live, work, and shop there, or is it purely residential? 2. Are the blocks short? Count how many intersections you hit in a 5-minute walk. 3. Are the buildings from different eras? Look for architectural variety. Different materials, different styles, different ages. 4. Is there enough density to support street life? Are there actually people on the sidewalk?
The eyes on the street test?
Stand on your block and ask, if a child were playing on the sidewalk, how many windows overlooked that spot? How many people would naturally notice if something went wrong? Not cameras, not police patrols, people. If the answer is 0, the street fails the Jacobs test.
What about when a new development is proposed? How do you apply your framework there?
The single most important question is, does this design prioritize cars or people at street level? Look at the ground floor. Is it retail? Does it have windows and doors facing the sidewalk? Or is it a parking podium, a blank wall, a lobby with tinted glass? Jacobs's test is whether the building engages the street or turns its back on it. A tower can be 50 stories. If the ground floor is dead, the whole project is anti-urban regardless of how many housing units it adds.
I want to circle back to something you mentioned earlier. Jacobs was accused of being anti-development, wanting to freeze cities in amber. That's a misconception, right?
She was not a preservationist in the freeze, everything since. She supported new development. She just wanted it to be incremental and integrated into the existing fabric. She opposed top-down megaprojects that wipe out whole neighborhoods at once. Her ideal was a city that constantly renews itself from within. Building by building, lot by lot, responding to demand organically. She was pro-change. She was anti-demolition ball.
There's a political dimension here that's gotten more complicated over time. Her anti-mega project stance has sometimes been weaponized by NIMBYs to oppose any new housing at all.
This is the great irony of her legacy. Jacobs fought highway builders and urban renewal bureaucrats who wanted to destroy working-class neighborhoods. Today, her arguments about neighborhood character and organic change are often used by wealthy homeowners to block apartment buildings and affordable housing. The same ideas that saved Greenwich Village from a highway are now used to keep new residents out of Greenwich Village.
Is that a fair reading of her, or a hijacking?
It's a hijacking, but it's not entirely baseless. Jacobs did value neighborhood self-determination, and she was skeptical of large-scale interventions. If you squint, you can read that as a NIMBY charter. But she also believed in density, in mixing incomes, in allowing neighborhoods to change. She would be horrified by the idea that her work is being used to enforce exclusionary zoning in the name of neighborhood character.
How do you square that circle? Can Jacobs's organic bottom-up model scale to address things like the housing crisis and climate adaptation?
I think it can, but not on its own. The pure Jacobs model assumes a functioning city with organic demand and incremental investment. It doesn't directly address what to do when you need 50,000 new housing units in 5 years, or when you need to retrofit an entire floodplain. For those challenges, you need planning. Smart, data-informed, Jacobs-compatible planning, but planning nonetheless. The trick is to do the big stuff without killing the small stuff.
Which brings us to the present moment. There's a whole wave of AI-driven urban simulation tools now. IT's CityScope. Digital twins of cities that can model pedestrian flows, energy use, traffic patterns. Is that a return to top-down planning dressed in data? Or can Jacobs' human-scale wisdom actually be encoded into algorithms?
That's the open question, and it's a big one. On one hand, these tools are amazing at optimizing for things Jacobs cared about. Walkability, street-level activity, mixed-use viability. You can simulate a new development and see exactly how it affects pedestrian counts at different times of day. On the other hand, the whole point of Jacobs was that cities are too complex to be optimized from above. The sidewalk ballet can't be simulated. The shopkeeper who sweeps the sidewalk doesn't show up in a digital twin.
The map is not the territory, and the model is not the neighborhood.
And there's a real risk that these tools give planners a false sense of confidence, that they'll think they've captured the city in a model and stop paying attention to what's actually happening on the ground. Jacobs's whole method was looking out the window. You can't outsource that to a simulation.
All right, let's pull this together. We've covered her four conditions: eyes on the street, her battles with Robert Moses, the influence on Gehl and new urbanism and spec, the tensions in her legacy. What's the one thing you want a listener to take away?
That cities are not machines. They're ecosystems. They work through complexity, overlap, and messiness, not through separation and order. And the test of a good city is not what it looks like from a helicopter. It's what it feels like to walk down the street at 7 p.m. on a Tuesday. Are there people? Are there things to do? Do the buildings face the sidewalk or turn away from it? That's the Jacobs test, and it's just as valid now as it was in 1961.
If you're just getting started with urbanism, you don't need to read all 450 pages. Read the first chapter of Death and Life, then go for a walk.
Count the intersections.
Count the intersections.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The Atacama Desert in Chile is home to the oldest known artificially mummified human remains, the Chinchorro mummies, which predate Egyptian mummies by roughly 2,000 years. The name Chinchorro comes from a beach in Arica where the first mummies were discovered, and it likely derives from an indigenous term for a type of small fishing boat.
2,000 years before Egypt. I have questions, but I'm not going to ask them.
Here's what I keep thinking about. Jacobs wrote her book at a moment when cities were being hollowed out by highways and suburban flight. We're at a different inflection point now. Remote work, climate adaptation, housing shortages. But the fundamental question is the same. Are we building places for people or for systems? And I don't think we've fully answered that yet.
The next decade is going to be a stress test. Every city is trying to figure out what its downtown is for now that commuters aren't filling office towers 5 days a week. The ones that lean into Jacobs, mixed uses, walkability, street-level vitality, are going to adapt. The ones that double down on single-use office districts and parking infrastructure are going to struggle.
It's the same fight, different decade. Jacobs versus Moses, played out in city councils and planning departments across the country. Only now Moses has a digital twin.
Jacob still has the better argument.
This has been My Weird Prompts, with me, Korn.
Me, Herman Poppleberry. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, and to everyone who sent in prompts. If you want more episodes like this one, head to myweirdprompts.com or find us on Spotify.
Go walk your block. See you next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.